over the wall and into the moor. Must you do that? Asked Elva. Aragorn paused in the midst of checking the leg straps on Saphira's saddle and looked over to where the girl sat cross-legged on the grass, toying with the links of her mail shirt. What? He asked. She tapped her lip with a small, pointed fingernail. You keep chewing on the inside of your mouth. It's distracting. After a moment's consideration, she said, And disgusting. With some surprise, he realized that he had bitten the inner surface of his right cheek until it was covered with several bloody sores. Sorry, he said, and healed himself with a quick spell. He had spent the deepest part of the night meditating, thinking not of what was to come, nor of what had been, but only of what was. The touch of the cool air against his skin, the feel of the ground beneath him, the steady flow of his breath, and the slow beat of his heart as it marked off the remaining moments of his life. Now, however, the morning star Éardail had risen in the east, heralding the arrival of dawn's first light, and the time had come to ready themselves for battle. He had inspected every inch of his equipment, adjusted the harness of the saddle until it was perfectly comfortable for Saphira, emptied the saddlebags of everything but the chest that contained Gleda's Eldunari and a blanket for padding, and buckled and rebuckled his sword belt at least 5 times. He finished examining the straps on the saddle, then jumped off Saphira. Stand up, he said. Elva gave him a look of annoyance, but did as she was asked, brushing grass from the side of her tunic. Moving quickly, he ran his hands over her thin shoulders and tugged on the edge of her mail hauberk to ensure that it was sitting properly. Who made this for you? A pair of charming dwarf brothers called Umar and Olmar. Her cheeks dimpled as she smiled at him. They didn't think I needed it, but I was very persuasive.
I'm sure she was,
Saphira said to Aragorn. He suppressed a smile. The girl had spent a goodly portion of the night talking with the dragons, beguiling them as only she could. However, Aragorn could tell that they also feared her, even the older ones, such as Valdur, for they had no defense against Elva's power. No one did. And did Umar and Olmar give you a blade to fight with? He asked. Elva frowned. Why would I want that? He stared at her for a moment, then he fetched his old hunting knife, which he used when eating, and had her tie it around her waist with a leather thong. Just in case, he said when she protested. Now, up you go. She obediently climbed onto his back and locked her arms around his neck. He had carried her to the hill in that manner, which had been uncomfortable for them both, but she could not keep pace with him on foot. He carefully climbed up Saphira's side to the peak of her shoulders. As he clung to one of the spikes that protruded from her neck, he twisted his body so that Elva was able to pull herself into the saddle. Once he felt the girl's weight leave him, Aragorn dropped back to the ground. He tossed his shield up to her, then lunged forward, arms outstretched, when it nearly pulled her off Saphira. Have you got it? He asked. Yes, she said, tugging the shield onto her lap. She made a shooing motion with one hand. Go, go! Holding Brisinger's pommel to keep the sword from tangling between his legs, Aragorn ran to the top of the hill and knelt on one knee, staying as low as he could. Behind him, Saphira crawled partway up the rise, then pressed herself flat against the ground and snaked her head through the grass until it was next to him, and she could see what he saw. A thick column of humans, dwarves, elves, urgles, and weircats streamed out of the Varden's camp. In the flat grey light of early dawn, the figures were difficult to make out, especially because they carried no lights. The column marched across the sloping fields toward Urabain, and when the warriors were about 1/2 mile from the city, they divided into 3 lines. One positioned itself before the front gate, one turned toward the southeastern part of the curtain wall, and one went toward the northwestern part. It was the last group that Aragorn had hinted he and Saphira were going to accompany. The warriors had wrapped rags around their feet and weapons, and they kept their voices to a whisper. Still, Aragorn could hear the occasional bray of a donkey or the whinny of a horse, and a number of dogs were barking at the procession. The soldiers on the walls would soon notice the activity, most likely when the warriors began to move the catapults, ballistae, and siege towers that the Varden had already assembled and placed in the fields before the city. Aragorn was impressed that the men, dwarves, and Urgals were still willing to go into battle after seeing Shrukan. "They must have a great deal of faith in us," he said to Saphira. The responsibility weighed heavily upon him, and he was keenly aware that if he and those with him failed, few of the warriors would survive.
"Yes, but if Shrukan flies out again, they will scatter like so many frightened mice."
"Then we'd best not let that happen." A horn sounded in Urabane, and then another and another, and lights began to appear throughout the city as lanterns were unshuttered and torches lit. "Here we go," Aragorn murmured, his pulse quickening. Now that the alarm had been raised, the Varden abandoned all attempts at secrecy. To the east, a group of elves on horseback set off at a gallop toward the hill that backed the city, planning to ride up the side of it and attack the wall along the top of the immense shelf that hung over Urabane. In the center of the Varden's mostly empty camp, Aragorn saw what appeared to be Saphira's glittering shape. On the illusion sat a lone figure, which he knew bore a perfect copy of his own features, holding a sword and shield. The duplicate of Saphira raised her head and spread her wings. Then she took flight and loosed a stirring roar. "They do a good job of it, don't they?" he said to Saphira.
"Elves understand how a dragon is supposed to look and behave, unlike some humans."
The shadow Saphira landed next to the northernmost group of warriors. Although Aragorn noticed the elves were careful to keep her some distance from the men and dwarves so that they would not brush up against her and discover that she was as insubstantial as a rainbow. The sky lightened as the Varden and their allies gathered in orderly formations at each of the three locations outside the walls. Inside the city, Galbatorix's soldiers continued to prepare for the assault, but it was obvious as they ran about the battlements that they were panicked and disorganized. However, Aragorn knew their confusion would not last long. "Now," he thought, "now! Don't wait any longer!" He swept his gaze over the buildings, searching for the slightest scrap of red, but none met his eye.
"Where are you, blast it? Show yourself!"
Three more horns sounded, this time the Varden's. A great chorus of shouts and cries rose from the army. Then the Varden's war machines launched their projectiles at the city, archers loosened their arrows, and the ranks of warriors broke and charged toward the seemingly impenetrable curtain wall. The stones, javelins, and arrows appeared to move slowly as they arced across the ground that separated the army from the city. None of the missiles hit the outer wall. It would be pointless trying to batter it down, so the engineers aimed above and beyond. Some of the stones shattered as they struck within Urabane, sending dagger-like shards in every direction, while others punched through buildings and bounced up the streets like giant marbles. Aragorn thought how horrible it would be to wake amid such confusion with large chunks of stone raining down. Then activity elsewhere caught his attention as the shadow Saphira took flight over the running warriors. With three flaps of her wings, she climbed above the wall and bathed the battlements with a tongue of flame that to Aragorn's eye appeared somewhat brighter than normal. The fire, he knew, was real enough, conjured into being by the elves close to the northern part of the wall, who had created and were sustaining the illusion. The apparition of Saphira swooped back and forth over the same stretch of wall, clearing it of soldiers. Once she had, a band of 20-some elves flew from the ground outside the city up to the top of one of the wall towers, so they could continue to keep watch on the apparition as it ranged deeper into Urabane. "If Murtagh and Thorn don't show themselves soon, they're going to start wondering why we're not attacking the other parts of the wall," he said to Saphira.
"They will think we're defending the warriors trying to breach this section," she replied. "Give it time."
Elsewhere along the wall, soldiers fired arrows and javelins at the army below, felling dozens of the Varden. The deaths were unavoidable, but Aragorn regretted them all the same, for the warriors' attacks were merely a distraction. They had little chance of actually surmounting the city's defences. Meanwhile, the siege towers trundled closer, and flights of arrows leaped between their upper levels and the men on the battlements. From above, a ribbon of burning pitch fell across the edge of the overhang and disappeared among the buildings below. Aragorn looked up and saw flashes of light atop the wall that guarded the lip of the precipice. Even as he watched, he saw four bodies tumble over the side. They looked like understuffed dolls as they plummeted toward the ground. The sight pleased Aragorn, for it meant the elves had taken the upper wall. The shadow Saphira looped over the city, lighting several buildings on fire. As she did, a flock of arrows shot up from archers stationed on a nearby rooftop. The apparition swerved to avoid the darts, and seemingly by accident, crashed into one of the six green elf towers scattered throughout Urabane. The collision looked perfectly real. Aragorn winced with sympathy as he saw the dragon's left wing break against the tower, the bones snapping like stalks of dry grass. The imitation Saphira roared and thrashed as she spiraled down to the streets. The buildings hid her after that, but her roars were audible for miles around, and the flame she seemed to breathe painted the sides of the houses and lit the underside of the stone shelf that hung over the city.
"I would never have been so clumsy," sniffed Saphira.
"I know." A minute passed. The tension within Aragorn increased to a nearly unbearable level.
"Where are they?" he growled, clenching his fist.
With every passing second, it became increasingly likely the soldiers would discover that the dragon they thought they had forced down did not actually exist. Saphira saw them first.
"There,"
she said, showing him with her mind. Like a ruby blade dropped from above, Thorn plunged out of an opening hidden within the overhang. He fell straight down for several hundred feet, then unfolded his wings just enough to slow himself to a safe speed, before landing in a square close to where the shadow Saphira and the shadow Aragorn had fallen. Aragorn thought he spotted Murtagh on the red dragon, but the distance was too great to be sure. They would have to hope it was Murtagh, because if it was Galbatorix, their plan was almost certainly doomed to failure.
"There must be tunnels in the stone," he said to Saphira.
More dragon fire erupted from between the buildings. Then the apparition of Saphira hopped above the rooftops, and like a bird with an injured wing, fluttered a short distance before sinking to the ground again. Thorn followed. Aragorn did not wait to see more. He spun around, ran back along Saphira's neck, and threw himself into the saddle behind Elva. It took just a few seconds to slip his legs into the straps and tighten two on each side. He left the rest loose. They would only slow him later. The uppermost strap held Elva's legs also. Swiftly chanting the words, he cast a spell to hide the three of them. When the magic took effect, he experienced the usual sense of disorientation as his body vanished. It looked to him as if he were hanging a number of feet above a dark, dragon-shaped pattern pressed into the plants of the hill. The moment he finished the spell, Saphira surged forward. She jumped off the crest of the hill and flapped hard, struggling to gain height.
"It's not very comfortable, is it?" said Elva, as Aragorn took his shield from her.
"No, not always," he replied, raising his voice to be heard over the wind. In the back of his mind, he could feel Gleda and Umaroth and the other Eldunari watching as Saphira angled downward and dove toward the Varden's camp.
"Now we will have our revenge," said Gleda.
Aragorn hunched low over Elva as Saphira gained speed. Gathered in the center of the camp, he saw Blodgam and his 10 elven spellcasters, as well as Arya, who carried the Dauthdert. They each had a 30-foot-long piece of rope tied around their chests, under their arms. At the other end, all the ropes were bound to a log as thick as Aragorn's thigh, and equal in length to a fully-grown Urgal. When Saphira swooped toward the camp, Aragorn signaled them with his mind, and two of the elves threw the log into the air. Saphira caught it with her talons, the elves jumped, and a moment later Aragorn felt a jolt as Saphira dipped as she took up their weight. Through her body, Aragorn saw the elves, the ropes, and the log wink out of sight as the elves cast a spell of invisibility, the same as he had. Flapping mightily, Saphira climbed 1,000 feet above the ground, high enough that she and the elves below could easily clear the walls and buildings of the city. To their left, Aragorn glimpsed first Thorn and then the shadow Saphira as they chased each other on foot through the northern part of the city. The elves controlling the apparition were trying to keep Thorn and Murtagh so busy physically that neither of them would have the opportunity to attack with their minds. If they did, or if they caught the apparition, they would quickly realize they had been fooled. "Just a few more minutes," Aragorn thought. Over the fields flew Saphira, over the catapults with their devoted attendants, over banks of archers with their arrows stuck in the ground in front of them, like tufts of white-topped reeds, over a siege tower and over the warriors on foot, men, dwarves and urgles hiding beneath their shields as they rushed ladders toward the curtain wall. And among them, elves, tall and slender, with their bright helms and their long-bladed spears and narrow-bladed swords. Then Saphira soared past the wall itself. Aragorn felt a strange twinge as Saphira reappeared beneath him, and he found himself looking at the back of Elva's head. He assumed that Arya and the other elves hanging below them had become visible as well. Aragorn bit off a curse and ended the spell that had concealed them. Galbatorix's wards, it seemed, would not allow them to enter the city unseen. Saphira hastened her flight toward the citadel's massive gate. Below them, Aragorn heard shouts of fear and astonishment, but he paid them no heed. Murtagh and Thorn were the ones he was worried about, not the soldiers. Bringing in her wings, Saphira dove toward the gate. Just when it looked as if she was going to slam into it, she turned and reared upright while backflapping to slow herself. When she had reached a near stop, she allowed herself to drift downward until the elves were safely on the ground. Once they had cut themselves free of the ropes and moved out of the way, Saphira landed in the courtyard before the gate, jarring both Aragorn and Elva with the force of the impact. Aragorn yanked on the buckles of the straps that held him and Elva in the saddle. Then he helped the girl down from Saphira's back, and they hurried after the elves toward the gate. The entrance to the citadel took the form of 2 giant black doors, which met in a point high above. They looked to be made of solid iron and were studded with hundreds, if not thousands, of spiked rivets, each the size of Aragorn's head. The sight was daunting. Aragorn could not imagine a less inviting entrance. Spear in hand, Arya ran to the sally port set within the left-hand door. The port was visible only as a thin, dark seam that outlined a rectangle barely wide enough for a single man to pass through. Within the rectangle was a horizontal strip of metal, perhaps 3 fingers wide and thrice as long, that was slightly lighter than its surroundings. As Arya neared the door, the strip sank inward 1/2 inch, then slid to the side with a rusty scrape. A pair of owlish eyes peered out of the dark interior.
"Who are you, then?" demanded a haughty voice. "State your business or be gone."
Without hesitation, Arya jabbed the Douth Dare through the open slot. A gurgle emanated from within. Then Aragorn heard the sound of a body falling to the floor. Arya pulled the lance back and shook the blood and scraps of flesh from the barbed blade. Then she grasped the haft of the weapon with both hands, placed the tip of it along the right seam of the sally port, and said, "Verma." Aragorn squinted and turned aside as a fierce blue flame appeared between the lance and the gate. Even from several feet away, he could feel the heat. Her face contorted with strain, Arya pressed the blade of the spear into the gate, slowly cutting through the iron. Sparks and drops of molten metal poured out from underneath the blade and skittered across the paved ground like grease on a hot pan, causing Aragorn and the others to step back. As she worked, Aragorn glanced in the direction of Thorn and the shadow Saphira. He could not see them, but he could still hear roars and the crash of breaking masonry. Elva sagged against him, and he looked down to see that she was shaking and sweating as if she had a fever. He knelt next to her,
Do you want me to carry you?
She shook her head.
I'll be better once we're inside, and away from... that.
She motioned in the direction of the battle. At the edges of the courtyard, Aragorn saw a number of people, they did not look like soldiers, standing in the spaces between the grand houses, watching what they were doing.
Scare them off, would you?
He asked Saphira. She swung her head around and gave a low growl, and the onlookers scurried away. When the fountain of sparks and white-hot metal ceased, Arya kicked at the sallyport until, on the third kick, the door fell inward and landed on the body of the gatekeeper. A second later, the smell of burning wool and skin wafted out. Still holding the Dauthdert, Arya stepped through the dark portal. Aragorn held his breath. Whatever wards Galbatorix had placed on the citadel, the Dauthdert ought to allow her to pass through them without harm, even as it had allowed her to cut open the sallyport. But there was always a chance that the king had cast a spell the Dauthdert would be unable to counter. To his relief, nothing happened as Arya entered the citadel. Then a group of 20 soldiers rushed toward her, pikes outstretched. Aragorn drew Brisinger and ran to the sallyport, but he dared not cross the threshold of the citadel to join her, not yet. Wielding the spear with the same proficiency as her sword, Arya fought her way through the men, dispatching them with impressive speed.
"Why didn't you warn her?"
exclaimed Aragorn, never taking his eyes off the fight. Elva joined him by the hole in the gate.
"Because they won't hurt her."
The words proved prophetic. None of the soldiers managed to land a blow. The last two men tried to flee, but Arya bounded after them and slew them before they had gone more than a dozen yards down the immense hallway, which was even larger than the four main corridors of Trondheim. When all of the soldiers were dead, Arya pulled the bodies aside so that there was a clear path to the sallyport. Then she walked down the hallway a good 40 feet, placed the Dauthdert on the floor, and slid it back out to Aragorn. As her hand left the spear, she tensed, as if in preparation for a blow. But she seemed to remain unaffected by whatever magics were in the area.
"Do you feel anything?"
Aragorn called. His voice echoed in the interior of the hall. She shook her head.
"As long as we stay clear of the gate, we should be fine."
Aragorn handed the spear to Blodgarm, who took it and entered through the sallyport. Together, Arya and the fur-covered elf went into the rooms on either side of the gate and worked the hidden mechanisms to open it, a task that would have been beyond the same number of humans. The clanking of chains filled the air as the giant iron doors slowly swung outward. Once the gap was wide enough for Saphira, Aragorn shouted, "Stop!" and the doors ground to a halt. Blodgarm emerged from the room to the right, and keeping a safe distance from the threshold, slid the Dauthdert to another of the elves. In that fashion, they entered the citadel, one by one. When only Aragorn, Elva, and Saphira remained outside, a terrible roar sounded in the northern part of the city, and for a moment, the whole of Urubain fell silent.
"They have discovered our deception!"
cried the elf Uthinare. He tossed the spear to Aragorn.
"Hurry, Arjatlam!"
"You next," said Aragorn, handing the Dauthdert to Elva. Cradling it in the crooks of her arms, she scurried over to join the elves, then pushed the spear back to Aragorn, who grabbed it and ran across the threshold. Turning, he was alarmed to see Thorn rise above the buildings by the far edge of the city. Aragorn dropped to one knee, placed the Dauthdert on the floor, and rolled it to Saphira.
"Quickly!"
he shouted. A number of seconds were lost as Saphira fumbled with the lance, struggling to pick it up between the tips of her jaws. At last, she got it between her teeth, and she leaped into the gigantic corridor, scattering the bodies of the soldiers. In the distance, Thorn bellowed and flapped furiously, racing toward the citadel. Speaking in unison, Arya and Blodgarm cast a spell. A deafening clatter sounded within the stone walls, and the iron doors swung shut many times faster than they had opened. They closed with a boom that Aragorn felt through his feet, and then a metal bar 3 feet thick and 6 feet wide, slid out of each wall and through brackets bolted to the inside of the doors, securing them in place.
"That should hold them for a while," said Arya.
"Not for that long," said Aragorn, looking at the open sally port. Then they turned to see what lay before them. The hallway ran for what Aragorn guessed was close to a quarter mile, which would take them deep inside the hill behind Urabain. At the far end was another set of doors, just as large as the first, but covered in patterned gold that glowed beautifully in the light of the flameless lanterns mounted at regular intervals along the walls. Dozens of smaller passageways branched off to either side, but none were large enough for Shrukan, although Saphira could have fit in many of them. Red banners, embroidered with the outline of the twisting flame that Galbatorix used as his sigil, hung along the walls every 100 feet. Otherwise, the hall was bare. The sheer size of the passageway was intimidating, and its emptiness made Aragorn that much more nervous. He assumed the throne room was on the other side of the golden doors, but he did not think it would be as easy to reach as it appeared. If Galbatorix was even half as cunning as his reputation implied, he would have littered the corridor with dozens, if not hundreds, of traps. Aragorn found it puzzling that the king had not already attacked them. He did not feel the touch of any mind, save those of Saphira and his companions, but he remained acutely aware of how close they were to the king. The entire citadel seemed to be watching them.
"He must know we're here," he said, "all of us."
"Then we had best make haste," said Arya. She took the Dathdert from Saphira's mouth. The weapon was covered in saliva.
"Thorough,"
said Arya, and the slime fell to the floor. Behind them, outside the iron gate, there was a loud crash as Thorn landed in the courtyard. He uttered a roar of frustration, then something heavy struck the gate, and the walls rang with the noise. Arya trotted to the front of their group, and Elva joined her. The dark-haired girl placed a hand on the shaft of the spear, so that she too shared its protective powers, and the two of them started forward, leading the way down the long hall, as they hurried ever deeper into Galbatorix's lair.
The storm breaks.
"Sir, it's time."
Roran opened his eyes and nodded at the boy with the lantern, who had stuck his head into the tent. The boy hurried off, and Roran leaned over and kissed Katrina on the cheek. She kissed him back. Neither of them had slept. Together they rose and dressed. She finished first, for it took him longer to don his armor and weapons. As he pulled on his gloves, she handed him a slice of bread, a wedge of cheese, and a cup of lukewarm tea. He ignored the bread, took a single bite of cheese, and downed the whole cup of tea at once. They held each other for a moment, and he said,
"If it's a girl, name her something fierce."
"And if it's a boy?"
"The same. Boy or girl, you have to be strong in order to survive in this world."
"I'll do it, I promise."
They released each other, and she looked him in the eye.
"Fight well, my husband."
He nodded, then turned and left before he lost his composure. The men under his command were assembling by the northern entrance to the camp when he joined them. The only light they had was from the faint glow above and the torches planted along the outer breastwork. In the dim, flickering illumination, the warriors' figures seemed like a pack of shuffling beasts, threatening and alien. Among their ranks were a large number of Urgals, including some Kull. His battalion contained a greater share of the creatures than most, as Nasawada had deemed them more likely to follow orders from him than from anyone else. The Urgals carried the long and heavy siege ladders that would be used to climb over the city walls. Also among the men were a score of elves. Most of their kind would be fighting on their own, but Queen Islandzadi had granted permission for some to serve in the Varden's army as protection against attack by Galbatorix's spellcasters. Roran welcomed the elves and took the time to ask each their name. They answered politely enough, but he had a feeling they did not think very highly of him.
That was all right. He did not care for them either.
There was something about them he did not trust. They were too aloof, too well practiced, and above all, too different. The dwarves and Urgles, at least, he understood, but not the elves. He could not tell what they were thinking, and that bothered him.
"Greetings, Stronghammer,"
said Nargajvog in a whisper that could be heard at 30 paces.
"Today we shall win much glory for our tribes."
"Yes, today we will win much glory for our tribes," Rorin agreed, moving on. The men were nervous. Some of the younger ones looked as if they might be sick, and some were, which was only to be expected. But even the older men seemed tense, short-tempered, and either overly talkative or overly withdrawn. The cause was obvious enough. Shrukan. There was little Rorin could do to help them, other than to hide his own fears and hope that the men did not lose their courage entirely. The sense of anticipation that clung to everyone there, himself included, was dreadful. They had sacrificed much in order to reach this point, and it was not just their lives that were at risk in the battle to come. It was the safety and well-being of their families and descendants, as well as the future of the land itself. All of their prior battles had been similarly fraught, but this was the final one. This was the end. One way or another, there would be no more battles with the Empire after this day. The thought hardly felt real. Never again would they have the chance to kill Galbatorix. And while confronting Galbatorix had seemed fine enough in conversations late at night, now that the moment was almost upon them, the prospect was terrifying. Rorin sought out Horst and the other villagers from Carvajal, and the lot of them formed a knot within the battalion. Birgit was among the men, clutching an axe that looked freshly sharpened. He acknowledged her by lifting his shield, as he might a mug of ale. She returned the gesture, and he allowed himself a grim smile. The warriors muffled their boots and feet with rags, then stood waiting for the order to depart. It soon arrived, and they marched out of the camp, doing their best to keep their arms and armour from making noise. Rorin led his warriors across the field to their place before the front gate of Urabain, where they joined two other battalions, one led by his old commander, Martland Redbeard, and one led by Jormunder. The alarm went up in Urabain soon afterward, so they pulled the rags off their weapons and feet and prepared to attack. A few minutes later, the Varden's horns sounded the advance, and they set off at a run across the dark ground toward the immensity of the city wall. Rorin took a place at the forefront of the charge. It was the fastest way to get himself killed, but the men needed to see him braving the same dangers they faced. It would, he hoped, stiffen their spines and keep them from breaking rank at the first sign of serious opposition. For whatever happened, Urabain would not be easy to take. Of that he was sure. They ran past one of the siege towers, the wheels of which were over 20 feet high, and creaked like a set of rusty hinges. And then they were on open ground. Arrows and javelins rained upon them from the soldiers atop the battlements. The elves shouted in their strange tongue, and by the faint light of dawn, Rorin saw many of the arrows and spears turn and bury themselves harmlessly in the dirt. But not all. A man behind him uttered a desperate cry, and Rorin heard a clatter of armour as men and Urgles leaped aside to avoid stepping on the fallen warrior. Rorin did not look back, nor did he or those with him slow their headlong dash toward the wall. An arrow struck the shield he held over his head. He barely felt the impact. When they arrived at the wall, he moved to the side, shouting, "Ladders! Make way for the ladders!" The men parted to allow the Urgles carrying the ladders to move forward. The ladder's great length meant that the Cull had to use poles made of trees lashed together to push them upright. Once the ladders touched the wall, they sagged inward under their own weight, so that the upper two-thirds lay flat against the dressed stone and slid from side to side, threatening to fall. Rorin elbowed his way back through the men and grabbed one of the elves, Othiara, by the arm. She gave him a look of anger, which he ignored.
"Keep the ladders in place," he shouted. "Don't let the soldiers push them away."
She nodded and began to chant in the ancient language, as did the other elves. Turning, Roran hurried back to the wall. One of the men was already starting to climb the nearest ladder. Roran grabbed him by the belt and pulled him off.
"I'll go first," he said.
"Stronghammer." Roran slung his shield over his back, then began to climb, hammer in hand. He had never been fond of heights, and as the men and Urgles grew smaller below him, he felt increasingly uneasy. The feeling just grew worse when he reached the section of the ladder that lay flat against the wall, for he could no longer wrap his hands all the way around the rungs, nor could he get a good foothold. Only the first few inches of his boots would fit on the bark-covered branches, and he had to move carefully to ensure that they did not slip off. A spear flew past him, close enough that he felt the wind on his cheek. He swore and kept climbing. He was less than a yard from the battlements when a soldier with blue eyes leaned over the edge and looked straight at him.
"Bah!"
Roran shouted, and the soldier flinched and stepped back. Before the man had time to recover, Roran scrambled up the remaining rungs and hopped over the battlements to land on the walkway along the top of the wall. The soldier he had scared stood several feet in front of him, holding a short archer's sword. The man's head was turned to the side as he shouted at a group of soldiers farther down the wall. Roran's shield was still on his back, so he swung his hammer at the man's wrist. Without the shield, Roran knew he would have difficulty fending off a trained swordsman. His safest course was to disarm his opponent as quickly as possible. The soldier saw what he intended and parried the blow. Then he stabbed Roran in the belly. Or rather, he tried to. Aragorn's spells stopped the tip of the blade a quarter inch from Roran's gut. Roran grunted, surprised, then knocked aside the blade and brained the man with three rapid strikes. He swore again. It was a bad beginning. Up and down the wall, more of the Varden tried to climb over the battlements. Few made it. Clumps of soldiers waited at the top of most every ladder, and reinforcements were streaming onto the walkway from the stairs to the city. Baldur joined him. He had used the same ladder as Roran, and together they ran toward a ballista manned by 8 soldiers. The ballista was mounted near the base of one of the many towers that rose out of the wall, each of which stood about 200 feet apart. Behind the soldiers and the tower, Roran saw the illusion of Sephira that the elves had created, flying over and around the wall, breathing fire on it. The soldiers were smart. They grabbed their spears and poked at him and Baldur, keeping them at a distance. Roran tried to catch one of the spears, but the man wielding it was too fast, and Roran nearly got stabbed again. A moment more, and he knew the soldiers would overwhelm him and Baldur. Before that could happen, an Urgle pulled himself over the edge of the wall behind the soldiers, then lowered his head and charged, bellowing and swinging the iron-bound club he carried. The Urgle struck one man in the chest, breaking his ribs, and another on the hip, breaking his pelvis. Either injury ought to have incapacitated the soldiers, but as the Urgle bulled past them, the two men picked themselves off the stone as if nothing had happened and proceeded to stab the Urgle in the back. A sense of doom settled upon Roran. "We'll have to bash in their skulls or take off their heads if we're going to stop them," he growled to Baldur. Keeping his eyes on the soldiers, he shouted to the Varden behind them,
"They can't feel pain!"
Out over the city, the illusionary Sephira crashed into a tower. Everyone but Roran paused to look. He knew what the elves were doing. Jumping forward, he slew one of the soldiers with a blow to the temple. He used his shield to shove the next soldier aside. Then he was too close for their spears to be of any use, and he was able to make short work of them with his hammer. Once he and Baldur had killed the rest of the soldiers around the ballista, Baldur looked at him with an expression of despair.
"Did you see? Sephira!"
"She's fine."
"But..."
"Don't worry about it. She's fine."
Baldur hesitated, then accepted Roran's word, and they rushed at the next clump of soldiers. Soon afterward, Sephira, the real Sephira, appeared over the southern part of the wall as she flew toward the citadel, prompting cheers of relief from the Varden. Roran frowned. She was supposed to remain hidden for the whole of her flight.
Frithia, Frithia,
he said quickly under his breath. He remained visible.
Blast it, he thought.
Turning, he said, back to the ladders.
Why?
Demanded Baldur as he grappled with another soldier. Uttering a ferocious shout, he pushed the man off the wall into the city.
Stop asking questions! Move!
Side by side, they fought their way through the line of soldiers that separated them from the ladders. It was bloody and difficult, and Baldur received a cut on his left calf, behind his greave, and a severe bruise on one of his shoulders, where a spear nearly pierced his mail shirt. The soldiers' immunity to pain meant that killing them was the only way to stop them, and killing them was no easy task. Also, it meant that Roran dared not show mercy. More than once he thought he had killed a soldier, only to have the wounded man rear up and strike at him while he was engaged with another opponent. And there were so many soldiers on the walkway, he began to fear that he and Baldur would never make it off. When they reached the nearest ladder, he said, "Here! Stay here!" If Baldur was puzzled, he did not show it. They held off the soldiers by themselves until another two men climbed up the ladder and joined them, then a third. And at last, Roran began to feel as if they had a good chance of pushing back the soldiers and capturing that segment of the wall. Even though the attack had been devised as only a distraction, Roran saw no reason to treat it as such. If they were going to risk their lives, they might as well get something out of it. They needed to clear the walls anyway. Then they heard Thorn roar with rage, and the red dragon appeared over the tops of the buildings, winging his way toward the citadel. Roran saw a figure he thought was Murtagh on his back, crimson sword in hand.
"What does it mean?"
shouted Baldur between sword strokes.
"It means the game is up," Roran replied. "Brace yourself! These bastards are in for a surprise!"
He had barely finished speaking when the voices of the elves sounded above the noise of the battle, eerie and beautiful, as they sang in the ancient language. Roran ducked under a spear and poked the end of his hammer into a soldier's belly, knocking the wind from the man's lungs. The soldiers might not be able to feel pain, but they still had to breathe. As the soldier struggled to recover, Roran slipped past his guard and crushed his throat with the rim of his shield. He was about to attack the next man when he felt the stone tremble beneath his feet. He retreated until his back was pressed against the battlements, then widened his stance for balance. One of the soldiers was foolish enough to rush him at that very moment. As the man ran toward him, the trembling grew stronger. Then the top of the wall rippled like a blanket being tossed, and the onrushing soldier, as well as most of his companions, fell and remained prone, helpless to rise as the earth continued to shake. From the other side of the wall tower that separated them from Urbane's main gate came a sound like a mountain breaking. Fan-shaped jets of water sprayed into the air, and then with a great noise, the wall over the gate shuddered and began to crumble inward. And still the elves sang. As the motion beneath his feet subsided, Roran sprang forward and killed three of the soldiers before they were able to stand. The rest turned and fled back down the stairs that led into the city. Roran helped Baldur to his feet, then shouted,
"After them!"
He grinned, tasting blood. Maybe it wasn't such a bad start after all. That which does not kill.
"Stop," said Elva.
Aragorn froze with his foot in the air. The girl waved him back, and he retreated.
"Jump to there," said Elva.
She pointed at a spot a yard in front of him.
"By the scrollwork."
He crouched, then hesitated, as he waited for her to tell him whether it was safe. She stamped her foot and made a sound of exasperation.
"It won't work if you don't mean it. I can't tell if something is going to hurt you unless you actually intend to put yourself in danger."
She gave him a smile that he found less than reassuring.
"Don't worry. I won't let anything happen to you.
Still doubtful, he flexed his legs again, and was just about to spring forward when,
"Stop!"
He cursed and waved his arms as he tried to keep from falling onto the section of floor that would trigger the spikes hidden both above and below. The spikes were the third trap Aragorn and his companions had encountered in the long hallway leading to the golden doors. The first had been a set of hidden pits. The second had been blocks of stone in the ceiling that would have squished them flat. And now the spikes, much like those that had killed Wirden in the tunnels beneath Drasleona. They had seen Murtagh enter the hallway through the open sallyport, but he had made no effort to pursue them without Thorn. After watching for a few seconds, he had disappeared into one of the side rooms, where Arya and Blodgarm had broken the gears and wheels used to open and close the stronghold's main gate. It might take Murtagh an hour to fix the mechanisms, or it might take him minutes. Either way, they dared not dawdle.
"Try a little bit farther out," said Elva.
Aragorn grimaced, but did as she suggested.
"Stop."
This time he would have fallen, had Elva not grabbed the back of his tunic.
"Even farther," she said. Then,
"Stop.
Farther."
"I can't," he growled, his frustration increasing. "Not without a running start." But with a running start, it would be impossible to stop himself in time, should Elva determine that the jump was dangerous. "What now? If the spikes go all the way to the doors, we'll never reach them." They had already thought of using magic to float over the trap, but even the smallest spell would set it off, or so Elva claimed, and they had no choice but to trust her. "Maybe the trap is meant for a walking dragon," said Arya. "If it's only a yard or two long, Saphira or Thorn could step right over without ever realizing it was there. But if it's 100 feet long, it would be sure to catch them."
"Not if I jump," said Saphira. 100 feet is an easy distance."
Aragorn exchanged concerned glances with Arya and Elva. "Just make sure you don't let your tail touch the floor," he said, "and don't go too far, or you might run into another trap."
"Yes, little one."
Saphira crouched and gathered herself in, lowering her head until it was only a foot or so above the stone. Then she dug her claws into the floor and leaped down the hallway, opening her wings just enough to give herself a bit of lift. To Aragorn's relief, Elva remained silent. When Saphira had gone 2 full lengths of her body, she folded her wings and dropped to the floor with a resounding clatter.
"Safe," she said.
Her scales scraped on the floor as she turned around. She jumped back, and Aragorn and the others moved out of the way to give her room to land on her return.
"Well,"
she said,
"who's first?"
It took her 4 trips to ferry them all across the bed of spikes. Then they continued forward at a swift trot, Arya and Elva again in the lead. They encountered no more traps until they were 3/4 of the way to the gleaming doors, at which point Elva shuddered and raised her small hand. They immediately stopped.
"Something will cut us in 2 if we continue," she said. "I'm not sure where it will come from. The walls, I think."
Aragorn frowned. That meant that whatever would cut them had enough weight or strength behind it to overcome their wards. Hardly an encouraging prospect.
"What if we—"
he started to say, then stopped as 20 black-robed humans, men and women alike, filed out of a side passageway and formed a line in front of them, blocking the way. Aragorn felt a blade of thought stab into his mind as the enemy magicians began to chant in the ancient language. Opening her jaws, Saphira raked the spellcasters with a torrent of crackling flame, but it passed harmlessly around them. One of the banners along the wall caught fire, and scraps of smouldering fabric fell to the floor. Aragorn defended himself, but he did not attack in turn. It would take too long to subdue the magicians one by one. Moreover, their chanting concerned him. If they were willing to cast spells before they had seized control of his mind, as well as those of his companions, then they no longer cared if they lived or died, only that they stopped the intruders. He dropped to 1 knee next to Elva. She was speaking to one of the spellcasters, saying something about the man's daughter.
"Are they standing over the trap?"
he asked, keeping his voice low. She nodded, never pausing in her speech. Reaching out, he slapped the palm of his hand against the floor. He had expected something to happen, but still he recoiled when a horizontal sheet of metal, 30 feet long and 4 inches thick, shot out of each wall with a terrible screech. The plates of metal caught the magicians between them and cut them in two, like a pair of giant tin snips, then just as quickly retreated back into their hidden slots. The suddenness of it shocked Aragorn. He averted his eyes from the shambles before them. What a horrible way to die! Next to him, Elva gurgled, then slumped forward in a faint. Arya caught her before her head hit the floor. Cradling her with one arm, Arya began to murmur to her in the ancient language. Aragorn consulted with the other elves about how best to bypass the trap. They decided that the safest way would be to jump over it, as they had with the bed of spikes. Four of them climbed onto Saphira, and she was just about to spring forward, when Elva cried out in a weak voice, "Stop! Don't!" Saphira flicked her tail, but remained where she was. Elva slid out of Arya's grasp, staggered a few feet away, leaned over, and was sick. She wiped her mouth on the back of her hand, then stared at the mangled bodies that lay before them, as if fixing them in her memory. Still staring at them, she said, "There is another trigger, halfway across in the air. If you jump..." She clapped her hands together, a loud, sharp sound, and made an ugly face. "Blades come out from high on the walls, as well as lower." A thought began to bother Aragorn. "Why would Galbatorix try to kill us? If you weren't here," he said, looking at Elva, "Saphira might be dead right now. Galbatorix wants her alive, so why this?" He gestured at the bloody floor. "Why the spikes and the blocks of stone?" "Perhaps," said the elf woman Invidia, "he expected the pits to capture us before we reached the rest of the traps."
"Or perhaps," said Blodgarm in a grim voice, "he knows that Elva is with us, and what she is capable of." The girl shrugged. "What of it? He can't stop me." A chill crept through Aragorn. "No, but if he knows of you, then he might be scared, and if he's scared..."
"Then he might really be trying to kill us,"
Saphira finished. Arya shook her head.
"It doesn't matter. We still have to find him."
They spent a minute discussing how to get past the blades, whereupon Aragorn said, "What if I used magic to transport us over there, the way Arya sent Saphira's egg to the spine?" He gestured toward the area past the bodies.
"It would require too much energy," said Glada. "Better to conserve our strength for when we face Galbatorix,"
Umaroth added. Aragorn gnawed on his lip. He looked back over his shoulder and was alarmed to see far behind them Murtagh running from one side of the hallway to the other.
"We don't have long. Maybe we could put something into the walls to keep the blades from coming out." "The blades are sure to be protected from magic,"
Arya pointed out.
"Besides, we don't have anything with us that could hold them back. A knife? A piece of armor? The plates of metal are too big and heavy. They would tear past whatever was in front of them as if it were not there."
Silence fell upon them. Then Blodgarm licked his fangs and said,
"Not necessarily."
He turned and placed his sword on the floor in front of Aragorn, then motioned for the elves under his command to do the same. 11 blades in total they laid before Aragorn.
"I can't ask you to do this," he said. "Your swords..."
Blodgarm interrupted with a raised hand, his fur glossy in the soft light of the lanterns.
"We fight with our minds, Shadeslayer, not our bodies. If we encounter soldiers, we can take what weapons we need from them. If our swords are of more use here and now, then we would be foolish to retain them merely for reasons of sentiment."
Aragorn inclined his head. "As you wish." To Arya, Blodgarm said,
"It should be an even number if we are to have the best chance of success.
She hesitated, then drew her own thin-bladed sword and placed it among the others.
"Consider carefully what you are about to do, Aragorn," she said. "These are storied weapons, all. It would be a shame to destroy them and gain nothing by it."
He nodded, then frowned, concentrating as he recalled his lessons with Oromis.
"Umaroth," he said, "I'll need your strength."
"What is ours is yours,"
the dragon replied.
The illusion that hid the slots from which the sheets of metal slid out was too well constructed for Aragorn to pierce. This was as he expected. Galbatorix was not one to overlook such a detail. On the other hand, the enchantments responsible for the illusion were easy enough to detect, and by them he was able to determine the exact placement and dimensions of the openings. He could not tell exactly how far back the sheets of metal lay within the slots. He hoped it was at least an inch or two from the outer surface of the wall. If they were closer, his idea would fail, for the king was sure to have protected the metal against outside tampering. Summoning the words he needed, Aragorn cast the first of the 12 spells he intended to use. One of the elf swords, Laufin's, he thought, disappeared with a faint breath of wind, like a tunic being swung through the air. A half-second later, a solid thud emanated from the wall to their left. Aragorn smiled. It had worked. If he had tried to send the sword through the sheet of metal, the reaction would have been substantially more dramatic. Speaking faster than before, he cast the rest of the spells, embedding 6 swords within each wall, each sword 5 feet from the next. The elves watched him intently as he spoke. If the loss of their weapons upset them, they did not show it. When he had finished, Aragorn knelt by Arya and Elva, who were both once more holding the Dauntlet, and said, "Get ready to run." Saphira and the elves tensed. Arya had Elva climb onto her back while still maintaining her hold on the green lance. Then Arya said, "Ready." Reaching forward, Aragorn again slapped the floor. A jarring crash sounded from each wall, and threads of dust fell from the ceiling, blossoming into hazy plumes. The moment he saw that the swords had held, Aragorn dashed forward. He had barely taken 2 steps when Elva screamed, "Faster!" Roaring with the effort, he forced his feet to strike the ground even harder. To his right, Saphira ran past, head and tail low, a dark shadow at the edge of his vision. Just as he reached the far side of the trap, he heard the snap of breaking steel, and then the cringe-inducing shriek of metal scraping against metal. Behind him, someone shouted. He twisted as he flung himself away from the noise, and he saw that everyone had crossed the space in time, save the silver-haired elf woman, Yela, who had been caught between the last 6 inches of the 2 pieces of metal. The space around her flared blue and yellow, as if the air itself was burning, and her face contorted with pain. "Flauger!" shouted Blodgarm, and Yela flew out from between the sheets of metal, which snapped together with a ringing clang. Then they retreated into the walls with the same terrible shrieking that had accompanied their appearance. Yela had landed on her hands and knees close to Aragorn. He helped her to her feet. To his surprise, she seemed unharmed. "Are you hurt?" he asked. She shook her head. "No, but my wards are gone."
She lifted her hands and stared at them with an expression close to wonder.
"I've not been without wards since I was younger than you are now. Somehow the blades stripped them from me."
"You're lucky to be alive," said Aragorn. He frowned. Elva shrugged.
"We would have all died except for him," she pointed at Blodgarm, "if I hadn't told you to move faster."
Aragorn grunted. They continued on their way, expecting with every step to find another trap. But the rest of the hallway proved to be free of obstacles, and they reached the doors at the end without further incident. Aragorn looked up at the shining expanse of gold. Embossed across the doors was a life-sized oak tree that the leaves of which formed an arching canopy that joined with the roots below to inscribe a great circle about the trunk. Sprouting from either side of the trunk's midsection were two thick bundles of branches, which divided the space within the circle into quarters. In the top left quarter was a carving of an army of spear-bearing elves marching through a thick forest. In the top right quarter were humans building castles and forging swords. In the bottom left, Urgles, Kull mostly, burning down a village and killing the inhabitants. In the bottom right, dwarves mining caves filled with gems and veins of ore. Amid the roots and branches of the oak, Aragorn spotted Weercats and the Razak, as well as a few small, strange-looking creatures that he failed to recognize. And coiled in the very center of the bole of the tree was a dragon that held the end of its tail in its mouth, as if biting itself. The doors were beautifully crafted. Under different circumstances, Aragorn would have been content to sit and study them for most of a day. As it was, the sight of the shining doors filled him with dread as he contemplated what might lie on the other side. If it was Galbatorix, then their lives were about to change forever, and nothing would ever be the same, not for them and not for the rest of Alagaesia.
"I'm not ready," Aragorn said to Saphira.
"When will we ever be ready?" she replied.
She flicked out her tongue, tasting the air. He could feel her nervous anticipation.
"Galbatorix and Shrukan must be killed, and we are the only ones who might be able to do it."
"What if we can't?"
"Then we can't, and what will be."
He nodded and took a long breath.
"I love you, Saphira."
"I love you too, little one."
Aragorn stepped forward.
"Now what?" he asked, trying to hide his uneasiness. "Should we knock?"
"First, let's see if it's open," said Arya. They arranged themselves in a formation suitable for battle. Then Arya, with Elva next to her, grasped a handle set within the left-hand door and prepared to pull. As she did, a column of shimmering air appeared around Blodgarm and each of his 10 spellcasters. Aragorn shouted with alarm, and Saphira released a short hiss as if she had stepped upon something sharp. The elves seemed unable to move within the columns. Even their eyes remained motionless, fixed upon whatever they had been looking at when the spell took effect. With a heavy clank, a door in the wall to the left slid open, and the elves began to move toward it, like a procession of statues gliding across ice. Arya lunged toward them, barbed spear extended before her, in an attempt to cut through the enchantments binding the elves. But she was too slow, and she could not catch them.
"Let her!" shouted Aragorn. "Stop!"
The simplest spell he could think of that might help. However, the magic that imprisoned the elves proved too strong for him to break, and they disappeared within the dark opening, the door slamming shut behind them. Dismay swept through Aragorn. Without the elves! Arya pounded on the door with the butt of the Dauthdert, and she even tried to find the seam between the door and the wall with the tip of the blade, as she had with the sallyport. But the wall seemed solid, immovable. When she turned around, her expression was one of cold fury.
"Umaroth," she said, "I need your help to open this wall."
"No," said the white dragon. "Galbatorix is sure to have hidden your companions well. Trying to find them will only waste energy and place us in even greater danger."
Arya's slanting eyebrows drew closer as she scowled.
"Then we play into his hand, Umaroth Elder. He wants to divide us and make us weaker. If we continue without them, it will be that much easier for Galbatorix to defeat us."
"Yes, little one. But think you not also that the Eggbreaker might want us to pursue them? He might want us to forget him in our anger and concern, and thus to rush blindly into another of his traps."
"Why would he go to so much trouble? He could have captured Eragon, Saphira, you and the rest of the Eldunari, even as he captured Blodgam and the others. But he didn't.
Perhaps because he wants us to exhaust ourselves before we confront him, or before he attempts to break us.
Arya lowered her head for a moment, and when she looked up, her fury had vanished, at least on the surface, replaced by her usual controlled watchfulness.
What, then, should we do, Ebrithil?
We hope that Galba Torix will not kill Blodgam or the others. Not immediately, at least. And we continue on until we find the king.
Arya acquiesced, but Aragorn could tell that she found it distasteful. He could not blame her. He felt the same.
Why didn't you sense the trap?
He asked Elva in an undertone. He thought he understood, but he wanted to hear it from her.
Because it didn't hurt them, she said. He nodded.
Arya strode back to the golden doors and again grasped the handle on the left. Joining her, Elva wrapped her small hand around the shaft of the Dathdeut. Leaning away from the door, Arya pulled and pulled, and the massive structure slowly began to swing outward. No one human, Aragorn was sure, could have opened it, and even Arya's strength was barely sufficient. When the door reached the wall, Arya released it, and then she and Elva joined Aragorn in front of Saphira. On the other side of the cavernous archway was a huge, dark chamber. Aragorn was unsure of its size, for the walls lay hidden in velvet shadows. A line of flameless lanterns mounted on iron poles ran straight out from either side of the entranceway, illuminating the patterned floor and little else, while a faint glow came from above through crystals set within the distant ceiling. The two rows of lanterns ended over 500 feet away, near the base of a broad dais, upon which rested a throne. On the throne sat a single black figure, the only figure in the whole room, and on his lap lay a bare sword, a long white splinter that seemed to emit a faint glow. Aragorn swallowed and tightened his grip on Brisinga. He gave Saphira's jaw a quick rub with the edge of his shield, and she flicked out her tongue in response. Then, by unspoken consent, the four of them started forward. The moment they were all in the throne room, the golden door swung shut behind them. Aragorn had expected as much, but still the noise of it closing made him start. As the echoes faded to dusky silence within the High Presence chamber, the figure upon the throne stirred as if waking from sleep. And then a voice such as Aragorn had never heard before, deep and rich, and imbued with authority greater than that of Arjahad or Oromis or Hrothgar, a voice that made even the elves seem harsh and discordant, rang forth from the far side of the throne room. And it said,
"Ah, I have been expecting you. Welcome to my abode. And welcome to you in particular, Aragorn Shadeslayer, and to you, Saphira Brightscales. I have much desired to meet with you. But I am also glad to see you, Arya, daughter of Islanzadi, and Shadeslayer in your own right. And you as well, Elva, she of the Shining Brow. And, of course, Gleda, Umaroth, Valder, and those others who travel with you unseen. I had long believed them to be dead, and I am most glad to learn otherwise. Welcome all. We have much to talk about."